Good morning. It is great to be with you. I feel like after Andrea prayed, after our worship time, we should have just ended and went home. Like, it was like fantastic way for us to start our day. And then, oh my goodness, lots of announcements today, but like really cool announcements and really exciting things. And so I am just honored to be a part of this team, to be a part of you, a part of Union Center Christian Church. My name's Nate, and it is who knows what week of our year-long series that we are calling The Way of the Lamb. If you've noticed, probably thus far, though, maybe you've seen and felt like, as we're talking about the lamb, when you think of a lamb, you often, I don't know what you think about, but I think of an animal that is gentle and kind. And so we're, even as we're looking at this series, we're seeing the way of Jesus as a gentler, kinder, more loving approach to following Jesus. An approach that sometimes, I'm not sure if we look at cultural Christianity, if we see said same approach. Last week, we looked at the passage where Jesus calls us to deny ourselves and take up our cross. We saw that that is really pursuing the character of God in all things. It's a turning away from the acts of the flesh, which include things like hatred, dissension, division, fits of rage, and selfish ambition. The way of the Lamb turns toward the fruit of the Spirit, or you could say toward the character traits of God, the character of God, that is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Recently, you might notice up here is a little quieter. It's spring break at BU. We love our students. A couple of you still hanging out. Hey, how are you? You get to stay here in Binghamton. Welcome. But I got to talk to the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. Please pray for our students. Always continually praying for our students. We love them and so grateful that they get to be a part of our church here too. But they've got a whole ministry on campus, and recently they asked me to come in and speak. And I don't like to just speak like this. I like to have a little bit of an interaction with them when I get to do that. We also have other students that aren't just BU too, by the way, just so you know. So it's not just BU students that we should be praying for. So just making sure we're paying attention to that too. I got to ask them though, what is Christianity known for? And you would hope that they would say the fruit of the Spirit, but almost verbatim I heard works of the flesh. Hatred, rage, division, politics. They said Christians are known for what they're against, not what they're for. That's not the way it should be. It's not the way it should be. And maybe you sit here and you want to say, well, that's not me. I'm not like that. But I think the reality that we need to hear is that whether that's you and me, whether that's us or not, that's a sort of perception that we have to overcome. The way of the Lamb turns away from these acts of the flesh that maybe we are becoming known for, turns away from those things and turns toward the fruit of the Spirit. For love, joy, peace, and you could continue on. The way of the Lamb, as we hear Jesus say, he is gentle and humble in heart. The way of the Lamb is gentle and humble in heart. But as we talk about Jesus being gentle and humble, one of the biggest questions that I get, especially from followers of Jesus, is, yeah, but didn't Jesus clear the temple too? What about angry Jesus? Can we talk about angry Jesus? Well, I'm glad you asked. Turn to John chapter 2. Let's look at John chapter 2 together. John chapter 2. Let's start in verse 13. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. Verse 15, so he made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple courts, both sheep and cattle. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. To those who sold doves, he said, "Get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market." Verse 17, his disciples remembered that it is written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." Let's stop right there, and before we continue, let's pray. Jesus, please help us to see you here. Please speak to our hearts. Please tell us what you want us to hear. Please comfort us where we need to be comforted. Please convict us where we need to be convicted. Please help us to understand what it looks like for us in 2024 to follow in your way, which includes this account. Please help us. Illuminate our hearts. In Jesus' name, amen. There is an account of this temple clearing incident, this temple clearing moment. This temple clearing account is in every gospel, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and then here we find it in John. It's a clear event that we see. Jesus clearly cleared the temple. And naturally, people have found a way to fight about it. The first three Gospels put Jesus' temple-clearing moment at the end of his ministry, right before he goes into his Passion Week. Matthew, Mark, and Luke put this account there. But then John comes in and puts it at the beginning of his Gospel, so people fight about it. When did it happen? Are there two different accounts of Jesus clearing the temple? Did he clear it twice? Is there a contradiction in the Bible? Lots of questions that come up. People argue about it. And I wonder if maybe, yes, he did it twice, or maybe could John write part of his gospel with different themes? And so he wants to start with this theme. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe John just wants to highlight this event with the other passages. And I think I just want to acknowledge that people fight about this. So you might have this in your head. Did this happen once? Did this happen now? Did this happen later? I just want to encourage you for just a moment. It doesn't matter. It's okay. We'll get there. We'll figure it out. At the end of the day, it's not worth dividing over. There can be answers to the question. And you know what? You might not know the answer. And that's okay. Maybe this happened twice, or maybe it happened once, and John just writes it at a different point because he wants to highlight this moment with other things. But what really matters is that Jesus cleared the temple in anger. What really matters is that Jesus cleared the temple in anger. Now, I also want to acknowledge that some of you have a really difficult time with the way I just said that. Your experience with anger is from a very abusive spouse or parent. And I just want to acknowledge to you that you have the right to feel a little nervous about hearing Jesus showing anger, because your experience with anger has been deeply painful. So to hear Jesus clear the temple in anger, your first reaction is to feel a little closed off, feel nervous. I understand that. And that's okay to feel like that. Because probably people even told you, if you experience someone in anger, people probably told you that that person's anger was your fault. I understand that it could be difficult to hear that Jesus cleared the temple in anger. I've said this here before. I want to make sure I say it again. The anger of an abusive parent or spouse is not the anger of God. I'll say it even more strongly because some people need to hear this in the room. The anger of an abusive parent or spouse is evil and contrary to the character of God. The anger of an abusive parent or spouse is evil and contrary to the character of God. When Jesus clears the temple in anger, he doesn't have the anger of an abusive spouse or an abusive parent, or fill in an abusive boss. This is not the type of anger that Jesus has. In fact, I believe the temple clearing actually shows us insight into God's heart for those who have been abused and pushed to the margin. His anger is actually showing up for them. But in order to see that, we need to understand a little bit of the history of what happens in this passage, what's happening in this scene. So look back with me in verse 13. John 2:13. When it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found people selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. Okay, I have two history lessons for us this morning. And if you don't care about history, I give you full permission to check out for the next 10 minutes. It's probably going to be about 10 minutes. I'll give you permission to check out. I'll bring you back in when we get to the end of the history lesson with just a little takeaway, okay? It's okay if you do that. I will not be offended. Take a nap. We all need a good 10-minute power nap, right? History lesson number one, what? Every year, the Jewish Passover, there would be hundreds of thousands, yes, 200,000 to 300,000 people would pilgrimage to Jerusalem for the Passover. Do you hear that? 200,000 to 300,000 people descending on one city over 1 week in one weekend. That would be like the entire city of Binghamton, the Southern Tier, Endicott, Vestal, Johnson City, all of us going one direction and descending on a different city. That's a lot of people. People came from all over the known world, Jews and non-Jews, anyone who wanted to worship Yahweh, who wanted to worship God. They would come to the temple in Jerusalem to offer sacrifices. Sacrifices for their sin from the year. The Jewish people were living in a sacrificial system that God set up for them. And so they would come to Jerusalem to sacrifice for their sins for the entire year. This was a big deal for them. Like, you didn't want to miss out on Passover. The streets of Jerusalem would be packed. The lodging would be full. Restaurants, markets would be bustling. Kids running around. People walking the streets. Honestly, it was Israel's most wonderful time of the year because they were doing two things. They were sacrificing for their sins and they were celebrating their liberation from Egypt that happened oh so long ago. The Passover, I want you to think about some major holidays that we have. The Passover was like 4th of July meets Christmas, meets Thanksgiving, all in one. Like if you think each of those are three big holidays, the Passover was like all three of those together. That's how big of a deal this was. Everyone would then have to pass through the temple. So not only was this a big deal, it was all in one city and would all pass through the central part of the city through the temple, because each one would have to sacrifice for their sins. So Jesus walks in and takes it all in. He's taking in the scene, people everywhere, people mourning for their sins, people celebrating forgiveness of sins. And then this is going to get a little strange, I'm sorry. Sounds of animals, thousands, hundreds of thousands of animals. Smells of animals. Smells of animals. But then there was celebration, yes, because of forgiveness of sin, but also there was mourning. It was an ugly scene, too, because these animals would then be sacrificed. Sounds, smells of hundreds of thousands of sheep, goats, birds. Some people would bring their own animals from home that they raised. Others had the option to buy their sacrifice. And if you've heard this story before, maybe you've assumed that buying the sacrifices or people selling the sacrifices were the issue. But hear me in this. The selling of sacrifices was not the issue. Leviticus chapter 5 actually shows us that the temple could sell sheep, could sell goats, could sell doves. The Leviticus 5 tells us that they would have the option to buy their sacrifice. So some people couldn't bring it from home. Some people weren't raising these animals to come and be sacrificed. And it was actually pretty beautiful the way that God set it up. Because, yes, ideally people would sacrifice a sheep, but not everyone could afford one. Some people weren't able to afford that, so God gives them another option. Here, you could sacrifice a dove instead. So you could buy a dove if you need or bring in a dove. Or some people couldn't afford that, and so what they would do is they would bring in their finest flour, and there was like an economically tiered system that God set up to make sure that everyone could do this. And I love this because God required sacrifice, but he knew that not everyone could give the same amount. Okay, history lesson number one. God actually allows for them to buy sacrifice. The temple was actually allowed to be selling these sacrifices for people to buy. You don't believe me? Go read Leviticus 5. There's just a lot there, so we don't have time to read it all. The selling of the sacrifices wasn't the issue, history lesson number one. But the problem was, because there was a very big problem here, the problem was where the people were selling their sacrificial animals. So, history lesson number two, where? All of this happens within the temple complex. The temple complex was huge at the middle of the city. And this complex was built in layers. And so I'm going to put a picture up here. You're probably not going to be able to see all of it. I'm going to try to explain as much of it as I can. If that comes through, thank you. The very middle, so I don't know if you can see the number one, but the thing that has some yellow around the top, that's the temple building. That was like the temple. Everything else were layers of what they call different courts. The temple building. Everything was created in layers. Inside the temple building, there were two layers. The Holy of Holies and the Holy Place. The Holy of Holies the high priest was the only one that could go into the Holy of Holies, and he could only go into that room behind that curtain once per year. They were about to come up to that at the Passover. Then there was the other layer within the temple building where all the priests could go. And then there's a first level outside the building. So you can barely really see, but just around the building, the area around the building. This was where all the Jewish men could go. Then there was the next courtyard out, and in the next courtyard out, where you might see a lot of numbers, 6, 7, 5, 8, 10, those numbers don't matter, but really in that room, in that space, in that court, in that courtyard, that's where all the Jewish women could go. And then you go outside the big, large courtyard. You might see it there. You might be able to read it. Gentiles courtyard. That's where all the people of the nations could come and worship God too. Okay, history lesson's over. For those of you that checked out, I want a real life visual for just a moment. What that would be like for us in our visual would be like, I get to be right here. This room would be where all the priests or the Jewish men could be, where all the men could be in the room. Out there would be where all the members, the women members, so here would be the male members, out there would be the female members. And then out in the parking lot would be where all the non-members could be. If that feels a little icky, more on that toward the end, okay? But what Jesus does is he shows up and all the vendors are hanging out in the parking lot. All the vendors are selling all their animals, which they're allowed to do. But they're doing it in the parking lot where all of the non-members would have no space to show up. So they'd come up the hill and have to just keep going. That's what Jesus sees. That's what Jesus shows up and says, okay, so all the Jewish women can be in there, all the Jewish men can be in there, but all of the people of the nations have no space to be here at all. That's why he gets angry. All the vendors push the marginalized even further to the margin. All the vendors push the marginalized even further to the margins. And this wasn't just a happy accident. Honestly, you look at that temple picture and you're like, wow, look at all that space. Like, that kind of makes sense. This was the practice of the Jewish leaders. It gets really messy because Israel was occupied by Rome. And honestly, they didn't like Rome in their spots. They didn't like those that maybe did want to worship Yahweh, that did want to worship God. They didn't want them all in there. So they filled that area with their vendors. The vendors should have been outside the courtyards, not inside the temple courts. This scene had been unfolding. This doesn't surprise Jesus. This isn't his first Passover that he's ever been to. So when we see verse 15, Jesus does this. So he made a whip out of cords. This wasn't spontaneity. This wasn't spontaneous anger. This was not a fit of rage. This was premeditated. Now, for you, that might make it seem better or worse. I don't know. Some of you might appreciate hearing that Jesus doesn't just fly off the handle here. But for others, you still see this and it feels like premeditated violence. And that seems far from the God who says, I am gentle and lowly in heart. And I get that. I get how it could possibly feel like that. But I want to maybe here for a moment try to convince you that this isn't premeditated violence. It's premeditated justice. And they're different. Jesus, I believe, is not being violent here. Yes, he makes a whip, but he doesn't start whipping people or even animals. It says he drove all them from the temple courts. And you might think, yes, that's like hitting people, but no, then he says both sheep and cattle, but he's just driving them out, and then he scatters the coins of the money changers and overturns their table. To those who sold doves, he said, get these out of here, again, from the location where they were. Stop turning my father's house into a market. I believe what's happening here is Jesus is using this whip to herd all the animals out of the temple courts where they were, to put them where they should be, outside, and he overturns tables, scatters money, which probably happens when a couple hundred thousand animals start running out the gates. And then he uses his words for people, get out of here. Get these out of here. Stop turning my father's house into a market. The picture we see here is Jesus herded the animals out and he spoke to the people. He wasn't violent with any of them. Jesus wasn't violent in his anger. And I want to make that clear. Jesus wasn't violent in his anger. But I also want to make sure that's clear. And while this is true, Jesus isn't violent in his anger. He was very passionate in his anger. Verse 17 goes on to say, his disciples remembered, zeal for your house will consume me. Jesus passionately wanted his father's house to be a place of welcome for everyone. Not just the Jewish men, not just the Jewish women, but also for the nations. And when the religious system had created a setting that pushed people to the margins, Jesus made sure it was very clear that he would overturn that system. And he would overturn that system with passion and with zeal. So I think what this should do is it should cause us to reflect. Where does our religious system still push people to the margins? Now, our example of the parking lot and all the vendors and people having to drive by is a pretty aggressive example. But where do we still see that? And I'd encourage you not to just answer that yourself, but to think about those who say they are out at the margins. Don't just answer it for them. Hear from them. Ask questions with curiosity. Ask people who have said they've been pushed to the margins, people of color, people who are disabled, women, people below the poverty line, people from other nations. Maybe we need to listen more. Because what if maybe we're even doing all the right things? We're able to, they were allowed to sell the sacrifice. What if we're doing all the right things, but literally in the wrong places? What if our process is wrong, even though our content might be right? What if we need to pay attention to our ways of being, not just our theology? Because Jesus literally made space for people at the margins to come inside. That's what he's doing here. Those that did not have a voice, he wanted to make sure that they knew that they could be there, and he would overturn everything to make sure that they could be there. He spent his whole life caring for people at the margins, people that you and I probably wouldn't even want to get near. Jesus gets near and often touches them too, to show that he is breaking down the barriers. And I think this is the scene that we see today is a perfect example of how Jesus cares for those at the margin. He will passionately show up for those that don't have a voice. And I pray that for some of you that have been pushed aside, some of you who have been pushed to the margins, some of you who maybe have been on the receiving end of an abuse of power, I pray that you can see from a passage like this that Jesus is passionately showing up for you. And then for some of us, we need to reflect differently. This story should cause reflection in us. What do we learn from Jesus here? How do we show up passionately for those who have been pushed aside? How do we show up passionately for those who have even been pushed aside in God's name? And personally, this is where I think the tension comes in for me. Because Ephesians tells us, in your anger, do not sin. James tells us that the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. I struggle because when I see issues of injustice, I feel angry. And I think that's an anger that I would hope could possibly be a holy discontent or a holy anger. Anger is indeed a primary emotion around matters of injustice. We see this here. If we follow in the way of the Lamb, Jesus was angry at injustice. It's often why we confuse the Old Testament God to being an angry God and the New Testament God being a really loving, kind God. Well, Jesus was oftentimes angry in the Old Testament because God's people did not act with justice to the people around them or even the people within their own country, their own tribe. And so I struggle here because we should be angry toward matters of injustice, and yet still our anger should not lead us towards sin. It shouldn't lead us to abuse. It shouldn't lead us to retaliate. It shouldn't lead us toward violence. It shouldn't lead us to maligning someone's name or calling people names. It shouldn't lead us to oppress others. If your anger leads you to abuse or oppress, then your anger is opposed to God. The religious leaders of this day were doing what God told them, but they were just doing it in the wrong way. And I think we need to pay attention to that. Jason Porterfield, in his book, Fight Like Jesus, it's a lengthy quote, so stick with me here. He says, artists have promoted a violent version of the temple cleansing for centuries. You look up any picture of this, any artist rendering of this on Google, it's all very violent. The result of such a portrayal is that many Christians have found a convenient way to justify their own violent intentions. If Jesus hurt people with a whip, so the argument goes, then under the right conditions, his followers may also use force. But of course, these conditions are rarely identified. Instead, Christians have all too often divorced Jesus' actions from the issues that upset him. Today we're looking at the issues that upset him. Thus giving themselves free rein to respond violently in any situation. And then by classifying the whip as a weapon, they've concluded that any weapon may be used, even ones infinitely more lethal and indiscriminate than a whip. Indeed, the church has a long checkered history of latching onto this image of a whip-wielding Jesus and using it to justify horrendous acts of violence. This is how we end up with the Crusades of the Middle Ages. Or maybe Christian nationalism of the modern day. When we divorce this scene from the rest of Jesus' life, we begin to believe that we can take up any force that's necessary and believe that our anger can lead toward any means toward our end. Way too much anger and violence has been justified in the name of God because of this passage. And I think it's ironic because the passage is literally Jesus standing up for those who have been oppressed. We've often used this passage to justify our anger to hurt other people, yet Jesus is the one saying, I'm actually going to bat on their behalf. It's about how he stands up to the abuse of power, how he sets a clear boundary to those who are mistreating others. And to be clear, the way of the Lamb does not tolerate justice in the name of God. The way of the Lamb is to provide for those at the margins. The way of the Lamb invites us to join him in this endeavor. Because the way of the Lamb recognizes that all of us, going back to that picture from before of history lesson number 2, all of us were marginalized at some point, at some way. And so we should show up for others who say they are marginalized because we should know that we indeed were marginalized too. That thing that felt kind of icky, kind of gross, like how many layers away from God can I get? Jesus comes through and says, I'm going to pave the way. I'm going to clear the temple now. And you know what? I'm going to finish the job later and I'm going to really clear it later. Because within the temple, at one point, one time of the year, only the high priest could go behind the curtain. That means we wouldn't be able to go in. But yet Jesus made a way for all of us to be able to go behind the curtain. At the end of his life, Matthew 27, Jesus cried out in a loud voice. He gave up his spirit. In other words, on the cross, Jesus dies. And at that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook. The rocks split. Through his death, he created space for all of us to access him at all times. Brother, sister, we would have been the ones driving by in the parking lot. Unless you are ethnic Jew, we would have been the ones driving by. Jesus creates space for each and every one of us to have access to him at all times. We don't have to sit in the parking lot anymore. He has invited us in, and so intimately in, he's invited us to his table. At the table, all walls and barriers are broken down. Which is why today we are going to come to the table to remind ourselves that Jesus gave up his life to clear the way for us to have access to him at all times, because on one level or another, we would have been pushed out to different margins. And the people of God should be the place on earth where everyone can come together and say, yes, we are all equal before God here. I can bring nothing to earn my own merit. I can bring nothing to get me further inside. The people of God says, no, Jesus did that for us. He tore the veil and all of us have access because of him. And so today we're going to come to the table to remind ourselves that he paved the way for us to have access to him. the night before he made that way, he invited his followers to a meal at his table. He took bread and wine. He broke it, saying that this bread symbolized his body, this wine symbolized his blood, that would be the sacrifice that we should have had to pay for, but that he gave to us for free. And he said, do this in remembrance of me. The Apostle Paul says, proclaim this until he comes. Today, we're going to come to the table. And when we come to the table, if you are able to say, yes, I believe that. Jesus made way for me. If you have the faith in that, come to the table reminding yourself that Jesus paved the way for you. He paved the way for me. And the cracker, which represents his body, the juice, which represents his blood, will remind us that we have access to God at any time. As I pray, I'm going to ask our servers to come up, and then I'll give our further instructions. Jesus, you've cleared the way for us to come to you, for us to have access to you. Please remind us that today, because I know when I'm reminded of that, I treat the others around me differently. When I couldn't come to you, you made a way. Please remind us of that today. In Jesus' name, amen.